Watch Your Step. Welcome. You are back in the minefield where you're going to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. It has been, actually, I think, one of the most intriguing ethical weeks of the year. One of those weeks where an issue that we've been speaking about for years and years and years and years and years suddenly got new life breathed into it, and in such a way that forces us to think anew about the ethical and moral assumptions we bring to it. What am I talking about? Well, I've built the suspense beautifully. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. He'll tell you.
Hey, Waleed. What a great way of setting up the programs. I wonder if people are now, you know, casting their minds across the news cycle. What have I missed? Well, see if this jogs your memory.
The great thing is, it's going to be you that lets them down here. That's the genius.
Completely. Okay, so consider this question. Just how deep do doctors' moral obligations to their patients go? Is it the doctor's job just to get them well and get them on their way? Or is there a deeper form of attention, a kind of personal concern that is required of doctors? Now, this question has been discussed in medical ethical circles for a long time. It's even had its fair share of Hollywood treatments. Here's Rhonda Haynes' 1991 movie, The Doctor.
There's a danger in feeling too strongly about your patient. The danger of becoming too involved.
Jack.
Yeah. Surgery is about judgment. The judge, you have to be detached.
But isn't it unnatural not to become involved with the patient?
There's nothing natural about surgery. You're cutting open someone's body. Is that natural? One day you'll have your hands around someone's heart, and it's beating. And you'll think, uh-oh, I shouldn't be here.
Well, then all the more reason to care about what the patient feels.
The patient feels sick. A surgeon's job is to cut. You've got one shot. You go in, you fix it, you get out.
William Hurt, the 1991 movie The Doctor. That's the scene. You can hear his character there talking to a group of interns, talking about the dangers of feeling too strongly about your patients. And we've heard doctors feel very strongly about their patients this week, haven't we, Scott? We are, of course, referring to the refusal by certain doctors at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, the refusal to release their patients who are asylum seekers, if it means they're going back to immigration detention. Now, on the surface, this is a clinical decision. They're just saying that as caregivers, we cannot do this because they will come to harm. We will further damage these people by releasing them in this way. And so we have an ethical obligation as doctors not to do this. But that then means it is also a moral claim, Scott. And I wonder if what is so fascinating about this is that we've found, or the doctors have found, or forced upon us, an arena for having a moral argument that is not where we normally have these moral arguments. And maybe we don't know how to deal with that.
Yes, that's a great way of putting it. This is really interesting to me because, you know, this is, if there's any debate that we all kind of roll our eyes at because the same points are being made, the same counter and opposing arguments are often, you know, we've heard it all. We've heard it all since 2002, have we not? We've heard it all when it comes to asylum seekers. But I think you're right, Willie, that this is so consequent. This is so significant what the doctors have done. And I think it's all there in the way in which people have begun responding to it. So, you know, in the first instance, there is widespread community support for the statement. And I think, well, the very carefully considered statement that the doctors make. They did not make a political statement as such. They did not say, we will not release any patient that is in our care back into immigration detention. They did not say that. They say, we reserve the right on a patient-by-patient basis to assess whether their health, their well-being will continue to be cared for once they are released. In other words, there wasn't a kind of, you know, drum-banging political statement that was being made. They were simply going deeply into the nature, the moral obligations that adhere to their very vocation. But I think the other thing that they did, which is so interesting, this is a politically overdetermined debate. It's massively charged. As soon as you raise it, you immediately find yourself in a kind of partisan quagmire. Well, until sort of recently. Now it's bipartisan quagmire. That's exactly right. What's so interesting here is that by speaking about the duty of care that doctors have to these patients who they refuse to release back into situations where their well-being, where their health, where their integrity, where their dignity is going to be compromised, they evoked a moral terrain over which politics has no claim. And I think this is one of the problems with moral debate. You know, within public moral debate in this country, as soon as you come down on a particular position, you're immediately branded as being of the left or of the right. If you invoke, for instance, human rights and paying careful attention to the rights and the dignities of asylum seekers, that's immediately brushed as, you know, well, what are you doing? You're putting sugar on the table. You're creating pull factors for. And I think one of the things that the doctors have here done by simply going deeply into the integrity, the internal consistency of the moral obligations that adhere to the medical profession, they have reminded us that there is a moral terrain over which politics has no jurisdiction. And by doing that, they've relativized the political claim over these asylum seekers themselves. I think that is a huge development.
Right, so they've found a moral arena that sits outside Parliament, and as you say, that Parliament has no claim over, which is why it gets really interesting from here, because the political response to this was predictable. It became about stopping deaths at sea. I think, what did Malcolm Turnbull call this? The melancholy truth is that if we don't do this, then people die. Mm. I think was the phrase that he used in Parliament. So we're familiar with that reasoning. I think the thing to recognise is, whether you think it's cynical or sincere or whatever, that is still a moral form of reasoning. Hmm. It is putting forward a moral argument. It's just one that comes from a very different perspective and therefore sits irreconcilably with the moral perspective that the doctors are putting. And I would summarise it this way. Our argument on border protection in Australia, on asylum seeker policy, has become one that is so deeply and thereby invisibly steeped in utilitarianism, this idea that it's all about the greatest good for the greatest number. Now, the thing about utilitarianism, Scott, as you'll be well aware, is that it attaches no inherent value to the human being. In fact, it attaches no inherent value to anything much except the end result. So it's an ends justifies the means kind of discourse. And if some people have to suffer for the benefit of other people so that we can maximise the greatest good for the greatest number, then that's simply what has to happen. And if you're Jeremy Bentham, that's fine. That is perfectly moral action. And that is the argument that the government has, or really our political class, has now been running ever since our discourse on asylum seekers moved away from being a sort of nationalistic assertion of sovereignty to one that wore moral clothing. We do this because it's the only right thing to do. We have to brutalise people in order to deter other people so that they don't die at sea. So the utilitarian logic of that is clear. These doctors are anything but utilitarian. And the ethical overlay of medicine is the antithesis, it would seem to me anyway, of utilitarian reasoning. Does that mean we're at an impasse?
Yes and no. Well, that's always the answer to these questions, isn't it? I mean, yes and no. It's not an impasse because to date, the utilitarian argument for border security, for immigration detention, has been really, really clear. The rights of certain people or certain forms of rights that adhere to certain people must be curtailed. They must be constrained. They must be traded off against the interests of the majority. That's a fairly straight utilitarian argument. And I think the way that you described the tone before as a kind of, melancholic resignation, okay, we don't want to do this, but really, this is the business of politics. We have to make hard decisions. Our hands are dirty. But, hey, what are you going to do? The opponents of that approach have kind of been dismissed as dewy-eyed idealists, haven't they? They're lax on border security. Are you going to, reopen the labor disaster that saw that many boats arrive in our shores and saw people dying at sea?
But also immoral for that reason.
Yes, yes. And there was something quite chilling not that long ago when I remember Chris Bowen, who himself, has moments of kind of political idealism, said, tell me what moral compass directs you towards allowing people dying at sea? What moral compass makes that somehow politically mandatory? But I think what is interesting is that there really hasn't been a clear alternative. I mean, if politics is a kind of grubby utilitarian business, you have to trade things off, then is there anything more jarring, but at the same time more exhilarating than the idea there are rights, there are dignities that adhere to people, and these exist, and these must be regarded, and these must be honored, regardless of whether the state wants to recognize them or not. I think what we've been lacking is an institution that names those and that guards those rights. In other words, it's, you know, that identification of certain rights and dignities has just been a bit airy. It's just been a bit idealistic. What the doctors here have done is they said, this is an institution. This is a profession that then guards it. And again, like I said before, it thereby curtails where the state can name its jurisdiction. I mean, you know, Waleed, you've been covering this for ages. Can you think of another event quite like this that really has, if you like, put politics in its place?
Not in this country, no. You occasionally see these sort of protests from lawyers, for example.
Yes.
In Pakistan, I remember there was a very famous, impeccably well-dressed protest from lawyers protesting for the independence of the judiciary, et cetera, et cetera. These sort of ideas that are actually founded on a moral bedrock. But we're not used to thinking of doctors in these sort of moral terms. They take an oath. That oath means something. It's an ethical commitment that they make. What I find fascinating about it is that they, in making this moral claim, are identifying that the moral sphere of concern that is appropriate for them, at the very least, is the person, the patient, that is in front of them.
That's right.
Not somebody else who is not in front of them but might be in front of them in the future, or someone who wants to be in front of them but can't get there somehow. It's not about the sacrifice of somebody right now for the benefit of saving somebody else possibly in the future. And here's one of the questions it raises a couple of questions. Are the doctors simply being irresponsible in having that narrow focus? Or are they, in fact, being far truer to the moral logic that set up our entire system of government by having a focus on the individual, the integrity of the individual, the rights of the individual, the humanity of the individual, which is a kind of personalist or otherwise inherently liberal argument, which you would think would hold sway in a liberal democracy? It's why we don't torture people, for example. Not because we think it doesn't work, although there is evidence to show that it doesn't, but because we hold a moral position that says you cannot do that to someone just to save other people. There is an inviolable integrity to the human being there. I think this is fascinating terrain. I also think there are interesting tests to how tightly reasoned the doctor's position is in this particular case. And that is what I want to explore next. You are in the minefield? Leave a comment on our website if you wish. RN The Minefield is what you should search for to find us. You can tweet us at RN The Minefield.
Doctors are put in a very difficult position because if we had a child that comes into our hospital that we feared if sending them back to an environment which we felt was going to be harmful, where they were at risk of abuse, we would be negligent if we sent them back to that environment. And that is what the doctors at the Royal Children's Hospital are saying. We cannot send children back to an environment where they're going to be harmed. Why are these children treated as any less of a citizen, as any less of a human than our own children?
That was Brian Aller, president of the Australian Medical Association, speaking to the Today program earlier this week. What he's saying there, it seems to me, raises huge implications. I mean, for instance, one of the big implications for me is, does this mean that those doctors that have in fact released patients, asylum seekers, back into detention, have they been negligent in their duties? Let's explore this with Deborah Zion. Deborah's the Associate Professor of Medical Ethics and the Chair of the Human Research Ethics Committee at Victoria University. So, Deborah, let me just put you on the spot. The doctors who have done this before, have they been negligent?
I wouldn't like to say that they'd been negligent. I think negligence is a very complex term, and it is also a legal term. I think one of the issues for me is that there was a big cone of silence around detention. And people could, I think, quite legitimately say, we've been assured that these people will be treated well. We've been assured that perhaps they won't be released back into detention. They might have been told they'd be released back into a community setting and have been looked after by one of the NGOs. But now I think that game is up after the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity hearing into children in asylum seeker detention. I don't think that there is any doubt now about what's happening. The detention landscape shifts constantly. I've been looking at issues around ethics in asylum seeker detention. This is my 11th year. And it shifts all the time. It's very, very difficult to pin down what's happening. And now, of course, it's more difficult because doctors have been told that if they speak to a researcher such as myself, they're liable for 2 years prison, which I think is also under the Border Protection Act, which I think is also a very, very, very worrying development. And it shows us that if there's that much secrecy, we can bet that detention's not a very safe place.
But these doctors, of course, are not bound by that act, which allows them to speak up and might be part of the reason they do speak up, because their colleagues offshore can't.
Well, whether or not they're... If they hear about what's going on in detention or they have themselves been in the detention setting, which some of them have,
right.
So there is a grey line there. They might be interviewed by the federal police simply for reporting what another person has said and been asked to disclose who spoke to them. So it is a very pernicious and I think actually quite an evil system now, where people cannot speak openly about very normal things like the care of a patient.
So these doctors are citing a body of research that demonstrates the mental harm.
Yes.
Or the harms of the mental illness,
yes.
Particularly children,
yes.
In detention, and
yes.
Saying we cannot in all good conscience return
these
people.
That's right, and physical illness as well.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a clinical decision.
Yes.
What my immediate thought when I heard about this was, on what basis can that sort of decision legitimately be made? How loose is this? So let's assume we're not talking about children in detention. Let's assume we're talking instead about a prisoner convicted of a crime,
mm-hmm.
who is ill and sent to the hospital to be treated, and you're treated by a doctor, that person is treated by a doctor who at the end of that process says, you know what, prison is really bad for people's mental health, I cannot release this person to go back to prison. Would that be an acceptable decision? Does that work within the ethical framework
yes.
that doctors
yes,
have to
I
work
Yes, I do.
With.
It doesn't mean that the person won't be detained, and it doesn't mean that they'll be let loose if they're a violent person to harm other people, although if they're very unwell, that may or may not be likely. But this happens all the time. Now, you know, people always compare asylum seekers to prisoners, which seems to me a very poor message, because asylum seekers haven't done anything.
It's not punishment, it's detention
it's punishment.
For administrative... Yes, I
yeah.
understand that point.
But to go back to your original question, yes, I think it would be quite legitimate to say this person has to be sent to a different kind of prison, where they are looked after differently, where they receive support services. Otherwise, they will die.
So let's make it even looser then. What if the doctor doesn't particularly like the look of the father of the child and thinks that the father's a bit abusive? Can the doctor arrogate to his or herself the right to determine that that child shouldn't go back to that family?
Okay, so, you know, one of the things that I think is very important in Australia is in most situations it's actually really, really hard to be a bad doctor because we have great systems in place. They're not perfect, but in global terms they're very good. So that if a doctor felt that a child was going to be returned to an abusive situation, there is a whole series of things that he or she is obligated to do. And that includes contacting social services, making sure that there is an assessment done of the household, making sure that there is future monitoring, and following up on the situation of that child. And that is actually an obligation that a doctor has in that situation. You can't just pass it off to the next person and wash your hands of it.
You can just say, I'm not releasing the child.
You could say, I'm not releasing the child till I am sure that this kind of monitoring has been set up to my satisfaction. And
okay,
the child perhaps will be placed in foster care.
But that monitoring doesn't exist in the case of asylum seekers.
No, there's no monitoring, and we actually have no idea what will happen to such a person when they're released back into detention. And it's very, very, very difficult to find out. In fact, almost impossible to find out. Or there has been a situation where doctors were told one thing and it has eventuated that something else actually took place, so that children or young people were supposed to be housed in Darwin or at MITRE and in fact have turned up again offshore. So I think, certainly those are reports that I have heard in the past. I think that it is very fortunate that doctors are taking a stand here and saying, well, in every other situation, I'm responsible for the ongoing well-being of my patient. We don't discharge people into unsafe situations in any other context. So why should we be obliged to do this here?
All right, so play with me a bit, and thank you for indulging me here, Scott. But let's see how absurd the examples can get before we say the doctor has no right to make this judgment. That's kind of what I'm trying to get at here. What if
you won't break me while
I'm not trying to. What if instead of the situations we've been talking about, it's a child whose parents refuse to vaccinate them, for example? Would the doctor be within his or her rights to say, I'm not going to release you because I think it will be bad for your ongoing health?
Okay, so this is clinical judgment here. If the child is being released into the middle of a measles epidemic, you might have, you know, a case to say this child should be vaccinated. I don't know if you're aware, but the rules around vaccination have just become a lot stricter.
Yes, we're talking about the no jab, no pay.
Yes, which we've discussed on this show.
Oh, yes.
But no, actually, the immediate harm of not vaccinating a child, and I'm a person who has vaccinated my children for every disease known to humankind, and I'm a staunch believer in vaccination, but unless there is actually an outbreak, given that the level of herd immunity in Australia is pretty high, that child's not really in danger. It might not be a good thing to do, but I think a doctor would have a very hard case to run to say the child himself or herself is in danger because the issue is about the community.
All right, and Scott will love this one. What if the doctor happens to be Richard Dawkins and believes that all form of religious education is tantamount to child abuse and sees that this child is in a religious family and thereby says, well, I can't release you because it would be harmful for you? I guess what I'm getting at is how idiosyncratic...
Okay, so it's not
how
idiosyncratic.
How subjective can the doctor be?
No, look, there is such a thing as clinical paradigms. I've been teaching ethics in medicine for nearly 20 years and, you know, I have a very good grasp of what the training is of young doctors and medical students. And the bar is set and there is a bit of room to manoeuvre, but it's not just about what the doctor thinks. And, you know, there are situations of conscientious objection, but there are a series of rules about what constitutes a risk, what constitutes a clinical indicator that there is a harm, and it's not just about what the doctor thinks. Now, if a doctor said, I'm not releasing you back into your family because...
Is your Scientologist?
Yeah, well, it would depend on what was happening to the child in that situation. Right. If the child was subjected to physical harm, then yes, there might be a case to answer. But if they just didn't like the way they think... then no, the doctor would be reprimanded for making a decision
I'll shut up now, Scott.
Well, as fascinating as this has been, there's been one other dimension to this that I'll confess, Deborah, has really, really intrigued me. I mean, one of the criticisms that's been raised about the whole regime of human rights discourse from the very beginning, I mean, I just think of someone like Simone Weil, who's been a great influence on me, writing in 1943. I mean, she insisted that human rights, much like utilitarianism itself, is actually a pretty sterile form of discourse. It's a commercial discourse. You can't help but end up trading, you know, one right against another right. And one of the things that Simone Weil, people like Hannah Arendt and others insisted, is that for human rights to in fact protect the people that they're meant to protect, there has to be a deep investment of profound emotion into it. And you know, Weil's word for this was attentiveness. That's what really struck me about, I mean, you could not listen to the testimony of the doctors and nurses without feeling their own sense of pain, their own sense of grief for their patients. Have they just re-injected into human rights discourse something I think that's been long lacking?
Well, I have a different take on human rights. I think that they're very hot, you know, and I think that they're full of emotion. And one of the ways that I would like to describe that is that a right is something that we have because the social order in which we live thinks it's so important that other people have duties to uphold it. And so that we're all upholders of rights and we're all upholders of duties. And if we think of ourselves as having those dual roles all the time, then I think that there is a lot of investment in it. You can't talk about the right to education if there is no school for people to go to. It's just a nonsense. So that to me is what makes rights and duties something in which we're all very, very highly involved. But I will say this, and this is, I think, a result of the kind of interpretation of rights that you're talking about. Human rights are really, really hard. And this is what's happened in this whole debate. We like them when they suit us. Human rights are hard. We have to accept that people we don't like very much, people we profoundly disagree with, have the same rights as we have. And that means we have to give things up to uphold their rights. That's our duty. And we don't like doing it very much. We're very, very lazy about it. So the alternative is to simply say, some people are less human than others. Well, we know where that road goes. It goes straight to the gulag.
Deborah Zion, Associate Professor of Medical Ethics and Chair of the Human Research Ethics Committee at Victoria University, our guest this week on The Minefield, which is now at a close, Scott.
Yes, and time will tell if this week ends up being as morally consequent as we suspect it might be. You can visit us at our website at RN The Minefield. You can also follow us on Twitter at RN The Minefield. We'd love to hear from you.
See you next week.
Hello, Patriots. I'm First Dog on the Moon. We're all as busy as a three-legged goanna up an angiokinus these days, and that's why you need to listen to my guide to modern living. Think of it as an imaginary helping hand from a pretend friend. Oh, what's in here?
First Dog on the Moon's Guide to Modern Living. Stream or download it at the RN website.
Put them in the van.
What? I work for RN. You can't...